Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started. Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
This 105 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, and of course we've got David North Martino.
Yes, I'm here.
Jerry Springer died, 79.
Yeah, I heard that. Wow,
kind of a shock.
It is.
So there you go. I mean, I remember him from years ago.
Oh, yeah.
More than recent times. But I guess the show kept going and then he got onto a judge show. But I never really followed any of that.
No, I didn't either.
You know, but way back in the old days.
Yes.
I would see him.
Me too.
Yeah. Well, you know, it wasn't really my style, but, you know, I never put down anybody. He was successful for a long time.
It was hard not to see stuff back then. We only had like three stations.
Yeah. Yeah, you can get lost nowadays. We will be talking to an author here. He's got a newest book out. It's called Hidden Cargo. It's a novel. Let's bring him in, Mr. Robin Lloyd. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
Robin, so I know you've got a little bit of a history, kind of like as a journalist, I guess, and things like that. How did you get into writing books? Like, what brought on the change for you?
Well, I had 30 years of working in broadcast news, 15 of those years with NBC, and then about 5 or 6 years doing local news. And then I went from there to producing stuff for public TV in Baltimore, Maryland. So there was a range of experiences, and I suppose some of the most intense were covering the wars and conflicts around the world, Central America, Latin America, Africa, Middle East. So I saw my share of broken societies, and I think that's what probably made me wonder, what was it like at the end of our Civil War? I knew that must have been lots of bitterness and lots of anger, confusion, chaos, but I had never really read a book that captured to me the pathos of what that end of the war was like. Yeah, so I started doing research, and I knew I wanted to do a sequel to the earlier book, Harbor of Spies. I knew I wanted to continue with the protagonist there, Everett Townsend, who'd been a blockade runner operating from Havana. And so I began researching Florida in 1865 and 1866 and discovered that it was indeed a fragile peace after the war. A type of Cold War, in fact, had emerged in Florida. Army soldiers who, interestingly enough, many of them were so-called colored regiments, were kept in place to keep the stability. But what I found in reading sort of local news is that you already had the beginning of pushback, basically, against the result of the end of slavery. And so slavery was over, but the fight to define freedom and equal rights for all was just beginning. And I thought, well, that is the type of backdrop that I want to dive into with the beginning of this book. And so, you know, I had my character, Everett Townsend, and he had now become a lieutenant in the Navy, operating from Florida, and had gone through 2 years of war in the Florida War, which was in effect like Vietnam. It was some of these boats were sent up the river to attack Confederate settlements, and then they'd get ambushed. So that was a calling to me, but I felt that I was more interested in writing about the end of the war and this man coming to terms with what he'd been through. It was a way for me to understand what that war was like by having him come to terms with it. His background was interesting in the fact that he had a connection with Cuba. So from the outset, I knew the centerpiece of the book's plot had to be about Townsend's return to Cuba. It had to be about him coming face to face with his own family's connection with slavery. He'd fought to end slavery during the war, but now I wanted him to struggle with a more personal interaction with slavery, that be with his family. So he would be getting involved in thorny topics like loyalty, betrayal, redemption. Like the country as a whole, this man was searching for the meaning of 4 years of war. Now, that was what I sort of set out to do, I hope I achieved it. because it was my attempt to understand at the end of the day, 4 years of fighting, what our country was like.
Well, one thing I just from living a while now, I realized that a lot of things, you know, the war ended and slavery was now gone legally. People no longer had slaves officially, but it takes a long time for society to grow into that new law, new way of living. Those years that you're growing through that, there's got to be a lot of turmoil. How do you capture that sort of a feel in a book? Where do you get that from in order to have people understand the struggle that was still going on?
Well, I think you have interactions which can help bring that forward. This book, what it attempts to do is to hear from all different voices of the time, not just a Northern Union Navy sailor, but also Southerners who had fought with the Confederates and who had become disappointed with the Confederacy. And then, of course, the African-Americans who what their mindset was, as well as the Cubans. That's why I chose Key West. Key West was this wonderfully diverse place in 1865. 2,500 people, a small ramshackle town of lots of wooden buildings. It was a seafaring harbor that was rough around the edges. And I thought, this is just the setting I want, because they had this interesting mixture of basically Southern, but it was a lot of Yankee merchants. And then it had this mix of Union soldiers, Army soldiers, and Navy men, because this was a headquarters of a naval fleet during the war. In addition, you had fishermen from Cuba and the Bahamas, an established black community there. All in all, it was, I thought, a very great spot because of its diversity to begin a story about the end of the Civil War, suggesting where do we go from here?
Yeah, it's an interesting time period. It's really hard to deal with compared to now. You talk about having a what you call a Cold War. How do you mean that?
Well, the interesting thing for me, it was actually fascinating to come across it, that the Department of War left behind colored regiments. So it was people of color in the Army who were stationed around Florida and, in fact, around the South, who were left behind. The other soldiers were discharged, but they had to have an occupation by U.S. Army troops, and in many cases, these were colored regiments. So you had this unusual situation where the Southerners who were trying to deal with so much, and the loss of their former lives and the change that came with the end of slavery, in terms of authority, they were looking at a man with a gun who happened it might have been a former slave. I found that absolutely fascinating, that that was the situation in 1865. And this book begins in the prison at Fort Jefferson on the Dry Tortugas. And there's a slight interaction there between Dr. Samuel Mudd, who was in prison there. He's the man who repaired the injury of John Wilkes Booth when he was attempting to escape. And Mudd, along with others, were sentenced to life in prison at this penitentiary out in the Tri-Tortugas, a terrible place. So there's a little bit of an interaction there with the central character, Townsend. And Townsend learns that Mudd has attempted to escape from this penitentiary out in the ocean, and he was captured. They found him, and they brought him back. And they asked him, why, Dr. Mudd, did you attempt to escape? And he said, I thought all these African-American or black soldiers around me would kill me. So it was fear that had made him try to do the impossible, escape from this penitentiary. But I thought that notion of fear was really what was behind not only the Civil War, but what came after the Civil War. Fear of what was going to happen to their lives now that slavery was over. And I thought I would try to put that in to the book, which I did in chapter one.
So your characters now, are they all fictional, or do you have some real ones and mixed with fictional characters?
I mix and mingle fictional with real. The real are not usually the primary figures in the book. The fictional ones are. But in doing historical novels, I think what gives resonance to the historical novel is if you can, for the sake of veracity, use some real characters and weave your story accurately in with these real characters, you enhance the, as I said, the veracity of your story.
Well, how do you get into the minds of your historical characters, especially your fictional ones? Are you pulling dialogue and stuff from what's been reported in the papers of that time?
My process of researching is I start with books that tell me the general picture of the time. I then go to scholarly articles that are more specific on what I'm after. And from there, I do a deep dive into newspapers of the time. So what does that do for me? In this particular case, I learned in Key West, and which was really one of the reasons why I wanted Key West as a way to begin this book, I learned that there had been a hurricane in October of 1865 that was just devastating to the state of Florida. In fact, created $2 million worth of shipping damages. So there were dozens of ships that wrecked on the coast of Florida. And I thought, this is such a metaphor for the end of war, that a hurricane strikes this part of the country and creates so much damage. And so the book begins with this Navy lieutenant trying to survive in the middle of a hurricane. And he comes across a shipwreck. And in the shipwreck, when they go to investigate, they find a horrifying sight of a cargo hold full of dead people. There's one survivor, and the one survivor basically sets the whole story in motion by saying, we are all freedmen from a plantation up the Mississippi River. They took us from there. We didn't know where we were going, but we were trapped, and all of them drowned except this one guy. And so that's how the story begins, and it sets in motion a mystery of what happened and how prevalent was this and what did it mean? You know, was this the beginning of a new slavery that was beginning? Some people in Washington thought it was, because these reports gradually grew, and they showed up in several newspapers and on testimony in the Hill with the Senator Sumner, who was a radical Republican of some note, virulently against slavery, said this is threatening our country and is going to send us into a new slavery. These reports have come from everywhere, Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana, Florida, and we have a major problem on our hands. So once I'd read that, and then I saw that Secretary of State William Seward, this is an actual fact, traveled to Havana, Cuba for talks with the Spanish officials there, and he was there for 2 or 3 days, I thought, well, this is really an issue that was of concern then, and it was very much of a, I think, the country trying to see, can we reconcile? Can we move on? This is a fragile peace we have. And in fact, Seward at one point said, even in the beginning of what was called the Reconstruction era, said we need to reconcile with the South. We have to find ways to reconcile with them. So I thought this dual theme of as we stepped into Reconstruction and we dealt with the reality of how do we reconcile, again, this story resonated as something that was significant in our history, but was a forgotten chapter. And nowhere had I ever heard anything about this. So, you know, I thought, this is, it's like a reporter finding a story. You know, you listen to a press conference or you go to some place and suddenly something happens and you say, there's the story. And that's what happened to me.
Is there a subtext or a meaning that you have that you want people to get out of reading a book in this series or even the whole series? Is there something under the entertainment value of the story?
In both the books, Harbor of Spies and Hidden Cargo, this young man is an intriguing character. He didn't come from any one person. He's a composite of character traits. He's an impulsive, headstrong, moralistic in terms of the Emersonian qualities of that word, very much a person from that time period. And he is given in life a contradiction. His family was divided by the war. His brother fought with the Lee's army and died at Antietam. His parents died during the war. And he's left with, the only thing left coming out of the war is a Spanish grandmother who he had on his mother's side, who owned a large plantation in Cuba with hundreds of slaves. And he knows, he feels obligated that he has to go back to Cuba because she's asked him to, and he feels obliged to. But he doesn't want to do it. At the same time, he's conflicted because he has a lady friend who has gone to Havana to live, and they had a relationship, but it hadn't worked out, and he wants to try to get back together with her. So you have this man being drawn to Cuba. There are pros and cons, but in his cards is he's going to confront his family's connection with slavery, and he's going to have to deal with the moral complexities of that as someone who was opposed to slavery and fought against it. So it's very much a look of one man coming to terms with what slavery has done to his family and what slavery that he perceives has done to society.
What does it mean for you when you write these books, when you put them together, done the research and actually get them published and stuff? Do you think there's a change in yourself?
Well, I think each book that you write, you explore different parts of your own psyche, your past, maybe memories, maybe persons that you met, maybe emotions that you've not recognized and they come out, maybe old fears that you had. So writing books for me, fiction, as opposed to sort of writing a memoir or writing a history, is very much of a catharsis of allowing stuff to come out of you that you didn't even know was in there. So for instance, for me, I had a childhood growing up in St. Croix, which was an unusual childhood. But from a very early age, I was raised there and in a very much of a West Indian background. And my father started a dairy farm and a dairy plant there. But he and my mother bought themselves a wooden boat. And with their free time, they took me from island to island. I saw most of the Caribbean from the deck of a wooden boat, and from an early age. So thus my interest in sailing. And I realized when I wrote my first book that I really enjoyed writing about the sea and about the effects of the sea on people, both the beauty and the cruelty of the sea. And I launched myself in a very unlikely way from broadcast reporter to historical novelist doing seafaring topics with mystery and romance involved. It was an unusual twist. It happened because at a time when I was sort of anxious to retire, and my last job was doing documentaries for public TV in Maryland, I thought, I do need to write this book about an ancestor of mine who was a good friend of Charles Dickens and who was an American Connecticut ship captain. And I didn't have enough in the way of diaries and memoirs, but I had quite a bit about the man's character, including stuff from Dickens himself describing the man. And I had a mystery. It was a family mystery that I found in researching this fellow, that his older brother had disappeared at sea. He wasn't dead, but he had disappeared. And I thought, well, that's a natural mystery. I've got a story here, and I was encouraged to write historical fiction. So try to do this man's story at sea, explaining how he met Dickens and how they became friends, but also solving the mystery of his brother. And that became the first book, which is Rough Passage to London. So in each of these books, I try to find a real mystery, something that actually happened. And I try to weave this fictional story into that mystery. So that's just my little quirky way of why I'm writing.
Is there something that surprised you when you're doing the research and finding? I mean, because you're a newsman, you've kind of been out in the world and you've been around, but when you were looking into the history and trying to cover this in a book, were there certain things that kind of came out that just sort of surprised you, you didn't expect to hear?
Well, in terms of the research, I was completely blown away by what I discovered of this kidnapping, because I went into the National Archives, Library of Congress, and I actually found the handwritten notes from the American consul in Havana back to Washington, where he says to the Secretary of State, we have 400 people who have mysteriously been landed on an island off the north coast of Cuba. They've been put in jail. The authorities said they thought they were Africans, but they're actually speaking English. We think that these are kidnapped Americans that are here in Cuba. And so an investigation was asked for from the Spanish. The Spanish, in characteristic fashion, denied that this was even a fact. They said there are no such people, and no investigation, I guess, was ever done. But it was something that really took my breath away a little bit, that this kind of thing was going on and that there apparently was nothing to be done, because the Spanish just closed the door and refused to investigate. And so that was certainly one surprise. I hadn't expected to really get as far as I did in the research. It's a mystery. No one will ever know how many of these people were taken to Cuba, but certainly some scholars say from 12 to 200, 300 are suspected to have been re-enslaved in Cuba. But no one will ever know. That's just one of those things shrouded in mystery, and I think gives an entryway for a historical novelist like myself to try to find answers where history has not. And so that was one surprise. I think another surprise that I got was really understanding the Southern mindset. I didn't really understand before getting into this book that Southerners really did not feel that they'd lost the war. I mean, the war had been lost militarily, but for them, it really wasn't over. And that surprised me. I, you know, there was no sense of contrition. There was no sense of the end of slavery was a good thing. Life went on, but it went on with a huge chip on their shoulder and it helps explain what happened subsequently, that the war, or the cause of the war, was never really addressed properly. Reconstruction did not do that. I don't know if it was possible. But in any case, that was a surprise for me that we had that kind of mindset. You know, for instance, I would have thought that Southerners might have been mad at Jefferson Davis, or they, you know, might have felt that the cabinet officials had not served the cause well. Not so. If you read about what the feeling was, they were still fervently behind Jefferson Davis and his cabinet. So that was a surprise. I guess a third surprise was the hundreds of Southerners who fled the country. They went to Mexico. They went to Brazil. They took their families. They decided our country was no longer for them, and they just left. Some of them went to Cuba. So there was this real division that, I didn't realize just how abrupt that was and how difficult it must have been to reconcile the country.
Very interesting. Do you find that you need to take a lot of literary license with this fictional story within any of your novels to make the plot work, or, you know, as in like compressing or expanding time, or can you just follow the history pretty accurately to make that the plot kind of go where you want it to go?
Well, I just use the history that I've researched, some of which I've talked to you about now, as a backdrop. I don't put that in literally. I try to tell myself that if an historian is reading this, I'm hoping that they won't find fault with what I've written. So I'm hoping that the historian, he may find flaws in what I've done, or he may say, well, that, you know, he's taken a liberty there. And perhaps I have, but I'm hoping that that's very minimal. I'm really trying to squeeze fiction into an outline of history.
Yeah, and I can't help but think that a lot of the content or subject in your books, in your stories, though they happened over 100 years ago, still they could relate to today's time, even now.
Well, I think that's the beauty of writing historical fiction, is that people really don't change. I mean, you know, there are some mannerisms and there are some expressions that change, but our characters are the same. Our motivations are similar. Yes, I mean, the beauty of historical fiction is we are they and they are us.
Yeah, it seems like we kind of have the same battles over and over and over each generation. Might do it differently, and they have different names behind it, but it's same sort of acts over and over, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote this book not with any concept of what we're going through today, but
right.
It was really about that time period. And I think, you know, I was motivated to do it because I'd seen so many broken societies with NBC. You know, I'd covered El Salvador, Nicaragua. I've been in and out of the Middle East. I'd covered various civil wars in Africa. I'd covered the end of the apartheid regime in South Africa. And so I'd seen divided societies. I'd seen, you know, the hatred that comes from one group oppressing another, or one group having battles with another. And I think that was what drew me to the idea of, what about our situation? And I suppose, even though I wasn't directly thinking of today's problems that we have, I must have had that in me as well.
Yeah, kind of comes in waves anyway, you know. I also, you know, one thing, like how you say, the South never really thought about losing the war, per se, or there's still that kind of concept. You know, growing up in the 60s and 70s, a lot of the movies and TV shows almost celebrated Southern, you know, pride, Confederacy and stuff. You quite often saw it in television, and I never could figure that out, considering they lost.
Well, I think if you read history, you can get an answer to that. The time period I am writing about is a very raw period where the loss is palpable. But over the decades, getting into the late 1870s, which is not in my book, but reconciliation became more important than reconstruction for this country. And the end result is that all sorts of recreating of the history happened. For instance, we had the Spanish-American War, and that was an interesting war because you had Northerners, ex-Northern soldiers, ex-Confederate soldiers fighting together for the first time under a common uniform, a common flag. You also had colored regiments. So you had black soldiers who had been stationed out west fighting Indians that came into the Spanish-American War. And what that did is it really healed the wounds that had been there all that time. And under the guise of reconciliation, I think history slightly changed. And we as a country acknowledged that the South had their own cause, which they fought nobly for, and that needed to be recognized. And then you had statues erected around the country for Southern heroes. And that happened in the 1890s or early 1900s. And the result was history was redefined from the history that I am writing about directly after the war, where Reconstruction was the primary mission of the federal government. By 1890, reconciliation had become far more important.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting when you get into that. How many books do you plan on doing? Do you have this sort of mapped out in your head already, or are you just kind of writing as you go?
Whatever the publisher says. if the publisher says you would entertain another book, I might start going in that direction. But, you know, if the publisher said, we've had enough of you, Robin Lloyd, I guess I might probably back off. I think it's just you have to have a publisher who likes you. And if that, I've been lucky enough to have one so far. But if there's interest, I'll think of another story to tell, probably.
It all depends on the backing, you know, and how that goes. So now, are you set up? Do you have like a website, social media accounts? Do you like to interact with readers? How are you set up?
I do have a website. It's nicely put together by a lady in Camden, Maine, and she Camden Graphics. She's done a great job. I've never really gotten into a lot of interactive back and forth. I guess I could if I felt that there was any interest, but I haven't done anything like that, no.
Okay. Well, we'll have your website and your book up anyway on our site so people can find you, you know. Did you have any issues writing over the COVID period, or was that sort of okay with you for writing?
Well, it was sort of interesting. I thought, gee, you know, Shakespeare wrote during the plague, and, you know, maybe he wrote some really good plays over the plague. Supposedly, he locked himself in a house and he wrote. But for some reason, COVID was not that for me. I was not speedy in writing this book. It took me, I guess, 3 years to write it. So I wouldn't say it slowed me down terribly, but it also didn't speed me up. I guess I would call it a walk.
Well, what takes the time for you? Is it the actual writing of the story, or is it the research that takes most of that 3 years?
The research takes a year. I mean, I literally take a year. It's like taking a course, and I become somewhat knowledgeable, I'm not an expert, about the area that I've chosen. And I, as I described to you, I go rather deep into research. Once I've done that, and I really feel comfortable with knowing an awful lot about that time period, I am willing to then go to create an outline. In writing a novel, nothing is regimented. Everything is fluid. And so there are times when I'm going to go back into research. There are times when I'm doing the research that I'm also thinking of how I could possibly turn this into a story. So it's all rather fluid. But I would say one year to research, 1 year to do a basic rough draft, really basic, and then finish it in a year. So it's 3 years. COVID was, I was thinking it took me longer, but that probably was about right, 3 years to do a book.
I wonder if old Shakespeare had to deal with wearing a mask at Costco and having people fight. Just kidding.
I don't even know if that story is true. That's something I may have heard or may have read.
Well, you know, great books, great story, and glad you came on to talk about them. Of course, now the new book is called Hidden Cargo. It's a novel. And our guest is the writer of the book, Robin Lloyd. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks, Alan. My pleasure.
Thanks, Robin.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts,
or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.